This is your Sunday morning wake-up call on WNRN. The wake-up call is brought to you by Tiger Fuel, homegrown since 1982. You can visit Charlottesville's only locally owned and operated chain of convenience stores today. They operate on Main Street, not Wall Street. The wake-up call is also brought to you by The Hook, an innovative weekly from the people who really know the news, on newsstands Thursday. Now your host, Rick Moore.
Hey, good morning, everybody. Thank you for tuning in to WNRN and the Wake Up Call. We're always thankful and appreciative for you joining us here on Sunday mornings. It is 11 o'clock, and especially thankful today to Lexington's 95.3 and Blue Ridge Mountain Sports for their support of WNRN. They celebrate 40 years as your local one-stop source for outdoor gear, apparel, and footwear. You can find fall warmth at Blue Ridge with jackets and vests and sweaters from the North Face and Patagonia and Mountain Hardware. Blue Ridge Mountain Sports is at Barracks Road here in Charlottesville. They have two locations in Richmond. For more information, it's online at brms.com. All right, thank you again for being here. And a special thanks to our guest today, the mighty Hawes Spencer. Good morning, Hawes.
Wow, the mighty. How the mighty have grown since I was last here.
Well, you know, you are the editor at The Hook, one of our weekly newspapers here in Charlottesville, underwriting for WNRN and especially for the Wake Up Call. And The Hook has once again earned several news awards recently, correct?
Yeah, I guess so. I guess so.
You know, that makes you, and all those things make you mighty.
Okay. Thanks, Rick.
Well, and I'll save that. I don't want to embarrass you too much as we start the show and put the level of our expectations too high.
No, let's set those expectations nice and low so we can exceed them.
I had a high school English teacher who apparently was going through a phase in life who, when we were reading Great Expectations, said, just to remind you, great expectations bring great disappointments.
Yes.
I don't know that you really want to teach that to high school kids, but our topic today, folks, Hawes is here again, editor at The Hook. We'll be talking about a couple articles from this current issue and one from the issue before that really deserve a little more airtime than just print time. So we're going to chat about those a little bit. One is a Superfund site here in the Charlottesville Albemarle area. And even as someone who was at the university during this time period, I was like, really? What? 1980-something? Are you sure?
Well, Rick, you know, a lot of people don't even, like the younger generation, doesn't know what the word Superfund means, because that's kind of an 80s term when the EPA got serious about cleaning up toxic sites all over America. And if you're in your 20s, you just would have been not born yet, so...
And I'm beyond that.
Yeah, you and I here.
Everybody in the studio at the moment.
Yeah, well, this is a gray studio right now, but but you know, for those who don't know, Superfund kind of conjures the worst of the worst in the history of American toxic waste sites. You think of places like Love Canal, that where they were just open pits of hideous chemicals.
Or Chernobyl, not necessarily a USA site, but you know that's the sort of thing the jokes are made about. Three Mile Island.
Yeah, well, those are nuke sites. What Superfund often deals with is groundwater contamination, because the American chemical industry had not as much scrutiny in the past, and companies could just dump their chemicals into the ground. And that actually happened here in Albemarle County, out in Greenwood, Virginia. And
where's Greenwood, for those who aren't sure? Because remember, we have listeners in Harrisonburg and Richmond.
Oh, yeah, of course. Well, Greenwood is about halfway toward the mountains from downtown Charlottesville. It's kind of... a little south of Crozet, right off of 250.
Actually, if you go to Crozet Pizza, you can be at the Greenwood Postal Building in within 5 to 10 minutes.
Yeah, it's beautiful out there, but behind that, beyond that scenery, is hidden this former chemical plant. It was called the Greenwood Chemical Company, and they manufactured a variety of chemicals for industrial processes and photography. And apparently, we're in the habit of just dumping the leftovers right there into the ground. And so what the EPA has been doing is pumping out the groundwater through a series of wells and then treating it or using carbon to extract the chemicals and then return the cleaned water to the ground. And this process has been going on really since the late 80s, and it's going to continue to go on for years and years. It's now the news out there is that it was handed over to the state in March of this year, and the state will continue the pumping and returning process. But, you know, they say the water is safe to drink for the people who live out there and who have wells. And we actually spoke to some people who will drink the water. We spoke to someone who wouldn't, but, you know.
Quick question. So, and again, I've read the article. This is from the paper from 2 weeks ago, correct?
Yes.
The one that is one that's currently on out in the boxes that we'll get to that major story about a new book about Thomas Jefferson and whether or not he's what's the proper phrase? Can't find it. Benevolent slave owner, or whether there's a little more moral issues there than that. We'll get to that a little later in the hour. But the previous paper has the Greenwood as the cover story. If the Charlottesville, or excuse me, the Virginia Department of Environmental Quality, if you pump out the groundwater to clean it, and then you put it back in to the ground, aren't you just, how are you not recontaminating it?
Because you've cleaned it once it's above the ground. They've built a whole kind of a water treatment facility out there, and they extract pounds and pounds of material all the time. And so it's just an ongoing process where they just pump it out, clean it, and return the good water.
So the ground itself has already been cleaned?
Yeah, like they dug up the waste pits, but they realized that a lot of that chemical material had leached into the areas. They couldn't dig up the whole area, which would just be like acres and acres and acres. And so that's the method that they're using. And hopefully it'll work. You know, like, I'll give you an example. Last year, more than 19 million gallons were pumped, treated, and then released back into the streams, and 55 pounds of contaminants were removed. So that's a lot of contaminants to my ears.
But despite that number, the EPA has declared, the Federal Environmental Protection Agency has determined that this is no longer qualifies as a, quote, Superfund site, and have turned it over to the state level.
Yeah, there's federal requirements that say that if a site meets certain criteria after 10 years of EPA operation and maintenance, they can turn it over to the state. And the state will spend about $400,000 a year annually to keep the system going. And there's really no sunset provision on when exactly the state will stop doing the pumping. But they can monitor. So right now, if they're taking out 55 pounds of toxins, then at some point, if they're only releasing a small fraction of that, they'll say, well, our work here is done. And I don't really know what that threshold is, or if they know what that threshold is. But in any event, if they're still pulling out 55 pounds of bad stuff, that means there's still some toxins in the ground.
I mean, I'm sure for many people, whether you've purchased a large bag of pet food, or something else that you've ordered or purchased, and you know what the 50-pound or something similar close to 55-pound bag is like, and you want to fill that full of toxins and claim that your area is still clean and fit for water, I think several of us might question the threshold, as you mentioned it.
We might. You know, Rick, one of the things that people may not have heard of was that this whole thing really came to the attention of the feds because there was a hideous disaster. There was an explosion on April 18th, 1985, that killed four men out of the 7 workers who were at that company. And the explosion and fire was obviously a really dramatic event in local history. And it's one that brought that that site to the attention of the feds.
Again, Hawes Spencer here. He's the editor at Charlottesville's The Hook. Talking about, we'll be talking about another story a little later in the hour about Thomas Jefferson. Currently talking about an issue that happened in Greenwood, Virginia, in the Charlottesville, Albemarle area, that was an explosion at a that brought forth, as you said, the toxic chemicals to the federal level. But they had, and I think I quote this from your article in The Hook, or, and I don't remember whether this was something that was quoted from another in the article, but it says that that the company was cited for, quote, continuing to operate in a manner demonstrably to the peril of the local community.
Yeah, that was in the article. This is a story by Lisa Province, and they that was the quotation.
So they've been cited for problems for at least several years, and the way I remember was a decade or possibly even longer for not acting in a proper manner for the toxins that they put forth. And then there's an explosion, and now people come forth and say, ooh, goodness, let's see what's going on over there.
Yeah, according to the neighbors, this was a place that always had sketchy aspects of environmental treatment. We talked, the reporter Lisa Province talked to one individual who lived out there, and he remembers seeing the creek near his house running bright red, and then another time he reported to her that it was running green. So when your creek is changing Christmas colors like that, that's probably not what you want.
There's also, and not to leave this story completely behind, but there's another business in the same area that is currently, I guess, Superfund. It hasn't qualified as a Superfund site, but has been set aside for toxic cleanup in that area, the Acme Visible place. For, some of us may know that as a property right next to the Star Hill where you can go get your growler filled.
Can you get growlers filled, or don't you just buy the bottles out there?
Well, when I go, I have the large glass growler.
Do you really?
So I go out there and I participate in the taste testing because I can't remember what it tasted like the last time I had it, and then I'll get my growler filled for,
nice,
for later participation.
Wow. Well, yeah, you're right. Acme Visible Records, a lot of old timers remember, is a plant in Crozet that made file cabinets and file folders, all the sort of office supplies from the pre-computer era. And Acme still is a brand that is producing these kind of old-school filing systems. Doctors' offices might use them. But what was less talked about was that they actually had a 1.6-acre lagoon on the property into which they would route their industrial wastewater. Again, not something that is an approved method in the modern era.
How big visually is is 1.6 acres?
Well, it's bigger than a football field. So
that's a pretty large lagoon.
Yeah, that's a lot of bad stuff. The EPA found 9 contaminants, including arsenic, benzene, and lead, that had seeped into the soil and groundwater there at Three Notched Road on the outskirts of Crozet at the Acme Visible Records plant. And they also, the most troublesome compound they found was a solvent called trichlorethene, also known as TCE. It's a carcinogen, and it's the toxin that featured in the 1998 John Travolta drama A Civil Action. You may recall that film about the residents of a town in Woburn, Massachusetts, who were allegedly susceptible to the same compound in their water.
Now, one of the differences is that the Greenwood site, that had been for over 27 years or so had been was being cleaned up. But the Acme Visible site site remediation doesn't begin until 2011. But that property has been empty for much longer than that. Why is this all happening at a much later date?
Well, part of it was Acme went bankrupt, and the manufacturing moved off-site, and then it was kind of a skeleton crew out there at Crozet under a new owner, excuse me, until about 2001. And it's the property now is in the hands of a Chicago company, which kind of acquired Acme's assets. And so a corporate switch left Acme in the hands of Beam, the people who make Jim Beam bourbon. And Wilson Jones is cooperating, and Beam is cooperating. And it's kind of like it's like a hot potato where you can't really sell the property until you clean it up. But the cleanup seems to be moving along, and the environmental authorities expect that it will be cleaned up. And, you know, Crozet is a booming area in Albemarle County. It's one of the designated growth areas, as you know, and it's got amazing views. And like you were talking about next door, you've got the wonderful Star Hill beer plant. They certainly don't want to be next door to anything toxic.
And I think I can speak for Mark Thompson and say they do not use the water from that area.
I don't know.
From the lagoon.
No. I think that Star Hill uses the Beaver Creek Reservoir, which is the water source for the public water system in Crozet. So, yeah.
Haas Spencer here talking about an issue from the October 11th paper of The Hook, 11/16 here on the wake-up call. Haas, back to the Greenwood part of that article. A big part of it had to do with the folks who live in, and I hear this from different people, like Stanton and Staunton, Newtown or Newton?
I think it's Newtown. Newtown was a small community of mostly African-American citizens whose history really has never been written down. It's such a small community. And on the one hand, the chemical plant in the neighborhood was seen as a boost for jobs, but now it's really harmed that community. The houses are hard to sell. We actually, Lisa Province took a phone call from someone after this article came out saying, oh my gosh, I just, you know, contracted to buy a house out there, and now I read your article. What do I do? And Lisa said, I don't know. I'm just a reporter. But, you know, if you were not told about this potential hazard in the area, maybe we should talk about that. And I don't know where that stands, but that's pretty interesting, isn't it?
Yeah, and I can't, you know, I'm flipping through the paper here, but there was a small part of it, a paragraph or two where the article interviewed someone in that area who is a realtor and who sort of talked about selling property in that area, and how because the article had moved on to drinking the water, who drinks the water, who doesn't drink the water, who finds it safe, who questions it, and then into the real estate part about whose responsibility is it to learn or provide discovery to this question.
That's a good question. And there, I don't know all the standards of the real estate industry, but at least knowing that there's this concern, one would hope that that would be information that would be handed over, don't you think?
Will the Hook, I mean, is there a plan now to do a follow-up on this? Or does this just, here's what we provided this, everyone, you know, we provided you the facts that we know, everyone talk about it, and if something else happens, we'll write about it again? Or is there already a plan for sometime in the future, or some trickle from this article that has got you leaning forward?
Well, like I was mentioning with the person who called us after the article came out, if someone was presented with a house and not told that there might be this concern in the neighborhood, that might be a story for sure. But the person has to be willing to talk about it. So we'll see.
All right, that's Hawes Spencer. We're talking about the cover story of the October 11th to issue Greenwood, EPA leaves Superfund site 27 years after fatal disaster. And Hawes, as always, people can go online. If you can't find this paper anywhere still around in the boxes,
go online.
Readthehook.com.
Yes, indeed, sir.
All right. 11:20 here on the Wake Up Call. Markets of Tiger Fuel forecast for Central Virginia and the Shenandoah Valley. It's mostly sunny today, highs near 67. And then clear tonight, lows in the lower 40s, even colder in Lynchburg and the Valley. Mostly sunny tomorrow, highs about 74. Right now, it's a beautiful day outside, 53 in the Valley, 58 in Lynchburg, 58 in Richmond, and 56 here in Charlottesville.
You're listening to the Sunday Morning Wake-Up Call, brought to you by The Hook and by the Markets of Tiger Fuel, homegrown since 1982. You can visit Charlottesville's only locally owned and operated chain of convenience stores today. They operate on Main Street, not Wall Street. Now back to your host, Rick Moore.
And thanks to Dixon Disposal for their support. Family owned and operated for 40 years, Dixon Disposal works to promote green awareness. Dixon offers all-in-one can recycling, so you won't have to spend time sorting or trying to figure out which items are recyclable. These recyclable items will not end up in the landfill, so for more information on the all-in-one can recycling, it's DixonDisposal.com or call them 978-2111. Now back with our guest, editor at The Hook, Hawes Spencer. And you're welcome to write down the number and call in. I didn't offer that opportunity for the last topic, but again, you can go online. The articles are there at readthehook.com. This next article may get a little more flash. Going, Hawes, the cover story for this week's issue, still out there and available, Mr. Jefferson's Greed, new book challenges image of reluctant slaveholder.
Yeah, Rick, this is a really fascinating story that's getting a lot of attention nationally. In fact, the buzz has been building all fall, where both Smithsonian and American History magazines have made it their cover story, these being nationally circulated history magazines that have found that this new book by an author named Henry Winsick, who lives right here in Charlottesville, and his book is called Master of the Mountain, Jefferson and His Slaves, which really portrays the author of the Declaration of Independence not as a benevolent and warm man at all, but as a cold, greedy, and lying racist.
And, quick question.
Yeah.
I set that aside here and put it in quotes. Cold, greedy, and lying racist. Word choice of The Hook or of the author? Because that's in the article.
Yeah.
And I think Lisa wrote this one as well.
Lisa wrote those words, and she's paraphrasing the book that she read. And
you can find those words used throughout the article that seem to come from the author, but I didn't see it in that. So when you say paraphrasing, he used the word greedy, and he used the word lying racist, and he used them, and she put them together because she felt that that was appropriate to what he would say.
You are correct, sir.
Okay.
Winsick does not mince words in discussing Jefferson. He has completely upended the notion of Jefferson as benevolent, and part of it is because he feels like historians who went before him have whitewashed the tale. He told us the story of a historian who found documentation that Jefferson allowed whipping of boys in his nail factory, little kids, and kind of pushed that out of his official report, and in so doing, basically lied by omission. And so Wincik has gotten all this national acclaim for creating this much more thorough look at Jefferson's slaveholding. You know, he allowed violent overseers who would punish errant slaves. I mean, Jefferson himself kept saying things like, oh, I want to get rid of slavery, and I'll probably, you know, get rid of my slaves. And one of his friends, Tadeusz Kosciuszko from Poland, a famous military leader, decided to leave a bequest, a big bequest to Jefferson, and Jefferson would only get the money if he let his slaves go, as his neighbor Edward Coles had done. And when Kosciuszko died, Jefferson was made aware of the big bequest, and it was contingent on him letting his slaves go, and he said no. Other things that Jefferson did in this book, that this book reveals, were he wrote letters where he said, you know, the way that the families grow creates wealth, because, you know, you're getting additional...
Because your female slave has children?
Yeah. And so...
And so then you've gotten more workers without having to pay for them.
Yeah. It's like free money. And so it's a really troubling set of facts for people who have idealized and or idolized the third president and the author of the Declaration.
11:26 here on the Wake Up Call. Our guest today, Hawes Spencer. He's editor at the multi-award-winning The Hook. If you go back and check, Hawes doesn't want to brag about it too much, it seems, at the start of the hour, but The Hook has won many, many awards for their writings. Please check it out. Hawes, a couple quick questions on this item. By the way, the article itself is based on a new book from Albemarle resident Henry Wincik, the book titled Master of the Mountain, Thomas Jefferson and His Slaves.
Oh, and Rick, here's, you had asked earlier about whether Henry Wincik used strong language, and I did notice that one of the things that Lisa quoted him in the article where he was conversing with Lisa, so this may or may not be in his book, but they were talking about the formula Jefferson calculated as what the birth of the slave children brought to him, which was a 4% annual profit. This is right out of a 1792 letter he penned to George Washington, who, I should point out, freed his own slaves after his death, which is not what happened with Jefferson. Jefferson, you may recall, died in such immense debt that his slaves were sold off, and any freedom that they gained was certainly not by Jefferson's actions. But here's what Wincik says about Jefferson's calculation in talking to Lisa Province. That was icy cold, says Wincik. The man is counting up babies and writing to a lender. That's why slavery is profitable. This SOB is utterly cold.
Okay, I can see where Lisa might quote or might paraphrase in the way that was done. 11:28 on the Wake Up Call. Open up the phone lines if you have a comment to make or a question about the article in The Hook. 979-0919, 1-877-WNRN Rocks is toll-free number. Hawes, the Hook on a weekly basis has something that's called The Hook's Question of the Week, where it seems that someone wanders the downtown mall, asks the question, and then The Hook selects three responses to put in there. But I've always assumed that you had more than three people who you were actually asking. And this week's question, do you think the negatives of Thomas Jefferson get downplayed here?
Well, Rick, that's actually one of the most interesting things to me about this whole story, is that remember at the outset I was telling you about these national magazines making this book a big part of their fall coverage. I mean, Publishers Weekly is a third public national publication. They're calling Winsick's book the number one history title of the fall and one of the best of all genres. And yet, get this, right here in Thomas Jefferson's hometown, the reception is decidedly chillier. We asked the director of Monticello for a quote, and what we got was kind of a non-committal, oh, there are many books published on Jefferson. We asked the recently retired research historian at Monticello, and we couldn't get a comment from her. And we talked to other Jefferson experts who are connected either to Monticello or UVA, and it was very tough to hear anything that even approximated praise for this book. Part of it is that much of what's in it is not tremendously new, that it's really maybe more of a repackaging of research that had existed before. But
well, that's one of the things that I found, is that a quote, I believe it was in Lisa's article, but from someone else, said that his book, Winsick's book on Master of the Mountain, Thomas Jefferson and His Slaves, reviews Jefferson's record like a prosecutor. So it seems to come, I took that as, this is an attack from someone who walks in with the negative belief already there. A prosecutor goes forward thinking that the person who you're questioning and studying is guilty of the crime, and it is now your job to prove that so.
You know, that's going to be an allegation. I think I read in this morning's Progress that Winsick was actually sort of addressing that very topic when he said that he went into the research hoping to have his perspective on Jefferson as benevolent confirmed, but that the information he found just couldn't support that. And so he asserts that his perspective is an honest one, born of the facts and not born of any preconceived notion. And when we heard from people like Peter Onuf, the Pulitzer Prize, and the Pulitzer Prize winning Annette Gordon Reed, these are a couple other Jefferson experts who have spent a lot of time locally. Onuf is at UVA. Gordon Reed comes down to Monticello a lot. She I'll digress for a second, but she wrote one of the greatest books about 15 years ago about Jefferson and Sally Hemings. She was trained as a lawyer, and she showed how the largely white historians had long discounted black oral history on the subject of Sally Hemings. And she wrote her book before the DNA came out that did show a positive link between a Jefferson and the children of Sally Hemings. And most historians, looking at the DNA combined with historical information, believe that the Jefferson who fathered Sally Hemings' children was most likely Thomas Jefferson. I remember at the time I was interviewing Dan Jordan, who was then the director of Monticello, and before the DNA came out, he took an approach of he didn't feel like it was going to be the case that Jefferson would be shown to be the parent of these slave children. But after the DNA came out, I think to his credit, Dan Jordan, then director of Monticello, convened a panel of esteemed historians, and they examined the DNA and they examined the history, and they concluded that Jefferson almost certainly was the father of children with Sally Hemings. And that showed to me an intellectual honesty, and I credit Annette Gordon Reed for being very early to the game in terms of reassessing the historical information. I mean, this stuff is fascinating. It goes to the heart of what Americans wonder about humans and their heroes and the the tragic history of our nation and the hypocrisies that are entwined with some of the people who are most important to us.
11:34 on the Wake Up Call. I'm Rick Moore. Our guest today, Hawes Spencer. He's editor at The Hook. We're currently discussing this week's issue, October 18th. You can find it on newsstands now. The cover story about Thomas Jefferson, a new book, Master of the Mountain, Thomas Jefferson and His Slaves, by Albemarle resident Henry Winsick. Sort of putting Jefferson, some would say, in a negative light, some would say in a more realistic light, some would say burnishing off the all positive aspects of Mr. Jefferson.
Rick, when you walk up to Monticello, that place is just gorgeous. But the sad fact is that if Jefferson had not been such a connoisseur of great beauty in architecture and food and wine and furniture, he might have been able to let the human beings go. He spent incredible amounts of money building Monticello. They sometimes give you that quote when you go up to Monticello about how he delights in tearing down and building up, and it sounds so cute and funny and, oh, he's such a great architect. But the flip side of that is tearing down and building up cost a lot of money.
It required hands.
And I think that this book is just asking us to consider that Jefferson may have turned not only a blind eye, but perhaps even a cold and calloused shoulder to the men and women and children who shared that terrain and who labored so hard to make his dreams come true. And none of this is to take away the greatness of his accomplishments with the fledgling nation, but I'm glad that we've had the opportunity to bring this side out.
Go back to the question of the week in this week's Hook. Do you think the negatives of Thomas Jefferson get downplayed here? And there's three people printed. One says, yes, I do. Second one says, they do. They all say, I do. Some of which have a sort of diminishing part to their answer. And it made me think of, yeah, but. And it's almost like Jefferson is, for many people here, whether we're a UVA graduate, whether we've lived here a long time, or just idealize him, I believe was the word you used, he's almost like a great-grandfather. So you recognize that there are negative aspects to it, but you have a hard time promoting that part of it because you're in some way related.
Yeah, you mean like...
I know that he had bad traits, but we're going to set those aside because of all the good things he did. If you say bad things about him, then you're saying bad things about me.
Are you though?
I'm just saying that's a lot of the aspect that goes into people. And how, you got the three answers to your question. Was that sort of, were they similar along all the answers that you did get?
You know, I the person who went out on the mall, I think, just in this case, got those answers from the first three people she encountered and went with it. And there's obviously going to be a greater range of opinions out there, and maybe we'll hear some more. But that's just what we got on the street.
And again, you talk about Monticello, but my understanding is that Monticello was actually, or I guess because it's past date now, actually did host the book launch.
They did.
For this.
Yeah. So it's certainly not to say that Monticello has given a total cold shoulder to this guy. They did indeed host the book launch a few days ago and had Henry Winsick speak. So, yeah, there's definitely been some acknowledgement that this is an important local work. And, let's go back for a second. One of the big debates going on is over the word presentism. For many, many years, decades even, we've been told that to judge people from other centuries is to commit the sin of presentism, you know, inserting our morals and mores onto another century. But one of the interesting things Winsick does is he shows that it's not necessarily presentism to free human beings. In fact, Winsick gives us the examples of George Washington and Edward Coles and others, and Jefferson himself in his writings, and saying, you know what, this is wrong, and we need to undo it. And what's so unfortunate with Jefferson is that, having the incredible role he had in the founding of the nation and having given such eloquent words to the rights of people to be free, if he had not been such a spendthrift, he just may have been able to have done what his peers were doing. And his, like I was telling you earlier, his friend Tadeusz Kosciuszko from Poland, everybody, all eyes were on him, saying, come on, dude, you're the freedom guy. I mean, to use 21st century language, hey, you're the freedom dude. Show the freedom love. And he didn't do it.
Well, why do you think it takes so long to have an author, historian, bring this forward? Because even Mr. Winsick has said, and I think Lisa Province in the article in The Hook brings this out several times, which is other authors and other historians seem to have, if not intentionally set this aside as facts to bring forth, diminished them.
You know, because it's because they're hideous. Well, the idea of,
but why do you have 10 people, and I don't know the numbers, but you have multiple people set this aside?
Because it doesn't fit the narrative, Rick. I mean, that's one theory that I'm going to give you. I enjoyed reading books by Jared Diamond, who talks about why we hear so little about genocide. Genocide is one of the most predominant attributes of 20th and 21st century world history. It's the body count from genocide is astronomical, and yet we do not typically address it or talk about it because it's so anathema to our perception of ourselves as world citizens in the modern era. But genocide is sadly more the norm than the exception. And I would argue to you that knowing that Thomas Jefferson, who penned immortal words of freedom, could allow the beating of little boys working in his nail factory, that is similarly outside of a good narrative about someone who we revere in other respects.
Again, Hawes Spencer here from The Hook, talking about this week's cover story on Thomas Jefferson, a new historical book brought forth with some beliefs that facts seem to prove, but many folks don't care to believe, or at least have trouble believing. Hawes, one of the things, and I can't find quickly as I flip through here exactly who said it. I want to say that it's Gordon Reed. What's her first name?
Annette.
Annette Gordon Reed. I believe this was from her, where she says that, talking about the book, that other incidents of the same nature have been discussed before, but in a different tone. Again, putting the negativity on the author rather than the subject.
She did say that, and that was something to which University of Texas history professor Jacqueline Jones countered by pointing out that he did go back to the original sources and he located material omitted by editors who were more interested in completing the more benevolent narrative. And secondly, the University of Texas professor suggests that sometimes you need to correct the recent scholarship and the perception of, you know, this tortured soul living on the mountaintop and sort of accidentally becoming this big slaveholder. Well, Wincik says no, there was nothing accidental about it. He was thoroughly savvy. He knew that he was making money from the reproduction and the increase of the human capital under his control. And so reasonable people will probably continue to debate these topics.
Do you believe, or did Lisa, in your understanding of what her studies in this topic, does this diminish the title of Jefferson as the sage? Because to me, when you call him the sage of the mountain, it's not just the intellect that goes with it, but it's also the ability to see the future in some way. Do these facts diminish that?
They certainly, I think they do, because a real sage would have been more progressive and would have done something beyond. It's like I had the pleasure recently of interviewing Mark Lane, who is a liberal lawyer who's been at the forefront of some of the most important moments in American history. And one of the things that really showed his forward thinking was he was a freedom rider. And the freedom riders, as you know, are those people who got on buses and traveled into the Deep South in the late 50s and early 60s with the then audacious idea that they would be able to travel together, people of different races, and have a cup of coffee together at a diner. And looking back, we all go, oh yeah, freedom riders, that was brave and that was bold. But at the time, it was really audacious. In fact, I went to a speech it was actually a speech in front of a movie at the Paramount Theater about a year and a half ago. Julian Bond and Larry Sabato were there, and Julian Bond was telling we in the audience that the great Martin Luther King Jr. was not a big supporter of the Freedom Riders, and that they were really troubled by his failure to get out there and give them what they felt like they needed, in because he already had national stature, and they're trying to do these Freedom Rides, and there's people who are greeting them with firebombs. So the mark of a true sage is somebody, I think, who gets out there with an idea whose time has yet to come. In fact, one of the great things that Mark Lane said to me in his backyard a couple of weeks ago, although he actually said it in his book, and I just asked him to confirm it, which was this little line: nothing is more dangerous than an idea whose time is yet to come.
11:48 here on the Wake Up Call.
You're listening to the Sunday Morning Wake Up Call, brought to you by the Market for Tiger Fuel and by The Hook, an innovative weekly from the people who really know the news, on newsstands Thursday. Here's Rick on what you can find on this week's Hook.
Yeah, this week's Hook: Regal's new 14-screen stadium seating theater at Stonefield is great news for moviegoers, but it could spell doom for its biggest competitor here in the Charlottesville area. The Dalai Lama spoke before a crowd in Charlottesville discussing love, compassion, and mindfulness, but did he really say that dirty word? And here is an idea both physical and conservatives, tree huggers, can agree on: the Western Bypass is a dangerous project that needs to be stopped. It's also disastrous, if I say that properly. An essayist explains it all. The Hook: you can handle the truth. And we also thank Blue Ridge Graphics for their support here at WNRN. You can find Blue Ridge Graphics at Meade Avenue and East High Street in Charlottesville, providing custom T-shirts and sportswear, plus promotional items for schools, organizations, and businesses. That's Blue Ridge Graphics, 296-9746, and at brgtshirts.com. Back with our guest, Hawes Spencer here. Hawes, one of the things that I think has gotten overlooked with the cover story of the last week or two, I found it in sort of smaller block in The Hook this week, is that the Jefferson Theater turns 100.
Oh, Rick, you could not mention a place any nearer and dearer to my heart than the Jefferson Theater. Because when I first moved to Charlottesville, I was a frequent moviegoer at the Jefferson. And then I had the incredible privilege of owning the facility for over a decade. And I will also have the privilege of appearing for a few seconds on stage tonight, introducing one of the bands at the 100th anniversary free concert. And last time I checked the website, jeffersontheater.com, there were still tickets remaining for this free show. It's a triple bill, which includes, no pun intended, the headliner is the Sons of Bill. And opening are Invisible Hand and Rayland Baxter. And as I said, it's a free show because 100 years ago tonight, the Jefferson Theater first opened its doors right there on Main Street, now known as the Downtown Mall, when the Jefferson was operating in an era of vaudeville plays and silent movies. And yet here we are, 100 years later, and the Jefferson is still rocking Charlottesville, different way perhaps.
1912.
It opened 6 months after the Titanic sank.
That's really putting things in perspective. Sometimes I have to, you know, when somebody says 40 years ago, I have to go back and like do the reverse math and go 40 years, 12, 38, okay. You know, or go, okay, 1962, 72, 82. Oh, no, wait, that's 50. Because I can't put that in perspective sometimes, but 1912.
I can help you put in perspective. When I owned the Jefferson, there were times when we were tearing, we were doing repairs, and we would have a wall kind of cut open, and embedded in the wall were little pipes that held the natural gas that provided the lighting. The Jefferson had natural gas lamps shooting flames out of the walls. That's how long ago it was before the advent of dependable electrical service.
Or apparently any sort of federal,
or federal
group
rules
telling you that was unsafe.
Well, you know, theaters, as you know from that era, were the sites of some of the worst calamities in American history. And the Jefferson, I'm proud to tell you, is mostly built out of brick and a ceramic block, like a terracotta block. The idea among fire experts of that era was to try to reduce the flammables in a building. Today's firefighting technology is more water-based because we have sprinkler systems that can suppress a fire once it starts. So anyway, I digress. Where were we going with this?
Well, you can't yell fire in a theater. You were talking about calamities
in
the natural gas. I mean, that's sort of where that phrase comes from.
Well, there were some huge fires where hundreds of people died. And so when movie theaters or combination theaters like this one were built, they were built with an eye toward making them fireproof. Now, ironically, the Jefferson burned just 3 years after it opened. In 1915, the whole central portion of the building burned to a crisp one night. They think that an errant spark left by a patron's cigar or cigarette ignited, and the place went up in flames. But it was quickly rebuilt. It was rebuilt better. They put in some structural steel to eliminate some poles that had been standing in the way of your views. I'll tell you another funny thing. You talked about 20, 40, 60 years, and it's hard to get a handle on things. The Jefferson Theater was built with very small seats because people were smaller back then. they just were. And the seats were not only were the seats narrower, but they were placed, the rows were squeezed in much tighter. The initial occupancy level of the Jefferson was about 1,000 people, which is higher back then than it is today. Today, I don't know what its actual fire marshal rating is, but I know it's somewhere in the 700 range. And that's because we just expect a little bit more elbow room, a little bit more, you know.
Well, you're a tall guy. You need some knee space.
Yeah, people.
And I have a big butt, so I need the wider. I need the wider seat. So, you know, we need to adjust to
times change.
That's
yes.
Right, to the times change. 11:54 here on the Wake Up Call. Talking with Hawes Spencer about some articles and recent papers and current papers, an event later today. Let me take a moment and thank L. Oppelman's for their support. You can find L. Oppelman's at 909 Main Street in downtown Lynchburg, operating since 1890, even before the Jefferson Theater. L. Oppelman's music department, now featuring acoustic guitars, mandolins, violins. They have electric guitar packages and complete drum sets. That's L. Oppelman, 909 Main Street in Lynchburg. Online, it's loppelman.com. And not that you would, but don't go anywhere, because in about 5 minutes, Les Temps Perdue will start up. It's the best of 80s and 90s alternative music, bringing you the best of alternative, because you can't understand where we are without first knowing where we've been. Take a trip to the times gone by with Les Temps Perdue here on WNRN. That's WNRN Charlottesville and WNRS FM Sweetbriar Amherst Lynchburg. Pause. Just another quick little bit about the Jefferson Theater. You talk about taking out the walls and finding, the natural gas lighting pipes. What did you do during your 10 years as owner? Because my memory of the Jefferson Theater are the midnight movies. There was actually, the balcony was separated from the main space down below, so there were actually two movies going on at one time. What are some of the things that you did as owner?
Mostly what I did was peeling back bad stuff put on in the 70s. I did do some construction backstage, where the backstage of the Jefferson became an art room where parties and dances and things were held, and unfortunately, that's probably the one thing that I did that got ripped out in the new configuration. Although I love the new configuration of the Jefferson, but that sort of stage room, which was just an incredible space because it was it's the tallest unreinforced masonry structure in all of Charlottesville, or it was when I owned it. The new owner, Corin Capshaw, has strengthened the Jefferson by adding structural steel in certain places, including a couple of big I-beams on the back of the stage house, which I'm very glad that he did. And I think that helped the Jefferson survive the earthquake here last summer. In some respect, that building could have become liquefied had Corin not become the owner, because, as you know, brick structures are among the most brittle in the pantheon of building types, and they can suffer catastrophic damage, and this one did not.
So did you buy the Jefferson as a historian, as a profiteer? Why did you
all those things?
All
Rick.
Those things.
Yeah, I like I was saying earlier, I was an avid moviegoer there, and the Jefferson sort of became this local sad case where it went into foreclosure. It had over $500,000 in loans placed upon it, and the owner had died, and his estate defaulted on the loans, and so it was sold on the courthouse steps, and I just happened to be the high bidder that day, thinking that my thinking was that there were so many apartments and rentable spaces in the Jefferson, and I knew that, and I figured that the rents would cover whatever mortgage I needed to own the building, and that I just would somehow figure out how to make the theater work. And as it turned out, I never really ran the theater so expertly. I did a few things that I think were good, like that thing I talked about a moment ago, where building that art space in the back so people could enjoy that back room. But I certainly was not going to have the music savvy like the current owner to book all these great bands in there. And so I I was pleased to operate it for all those years, but when the time came to take it to the next level, that's what happened.
All right, just a few seconds left. By the way, we were talking, you can find these articles online at readthehook.com. We were talking about the Greenwood, super fun site, current issue of The Hook, Mr. Jefferson's Greed, discussing a new book by a local historian about some of the more unpleasant aspects of Thomas Jefferson and historical fact. Hawes, next week here, Sean McCord will be interviewing Jody Kobasa about the Virginia Film Festival. What's upcoming in another upcoming issue or two of The Hook?
What is up in The Hook?
You are the editor, right? I thought that would pop to mind.
Yeah. We have a story about a man who says he's being hounded as a suspect in a murder case, and he alleges that police have used all kinds of questionable methods against him. And, of course, we'll continue to follow the case of the Albemarle County supervisor whose arrest has rocked the community. And as you alluded to earlier, we really want to see what happens when the new Regal Cinema 14-screen stadium seating facility opens on Hydraulic Road, because the owner of the Vinegar Hill Theater predicts that will be the death knell for the Carmike Cinema up at the Gardens Shopping Center.
All right. Thanks, Hawes.
Thanks, Rick.
Tamara Winograd up next with Les Timms-Perdue.
This has been your Sunday morning wake-up call on WNRN. The wake-up call is brought to you by The Hook, an innovative weekly from the people who really know the news. On newsstands Thursday, the wake-up call is also supported by the Markets of Tiger Fuel, homegrown since 1982. You can visit Charlottesville's only locally owned and operated chain of convenience stores today. They operate on Main Street, not Wall Street. Views and opinions expressed on this program are not necessarily those of the management, staff, or board of WNRN. You can contact Rick at abstractme@aol.com or wakeupcall@wnrn.org. The Wake Up Call is produced by Sean McCord. Tune in next Sunday morning at 11 for The Wake Up Call, only on WNRN.